Oh, hey, I'm glad you're here. I was just reminiscing about promotional materials. My dad's video stores would receive so much promotional material, just cardboard tube after cardboard tube of like 10 of the same Wizard of Speed and Time posters inside. We'd have stand-up displays for like Dangerous Liaisons, an enormous Child's Play 2 display where Chucky's holding the shears, gonna cut the head off a Jack in the Box. And actually, now that we're on the subject, that thing ended up in my childhood bedroom. It took up like a fourth of my room, and I would fall asleep every night looking at it. Yeah. So if my therapist is listening, watch Child's Play 2. There's probably something in there. All this stuff, though, would just be around. There was no, you know, it didn't cost anything. So you would just get stickers and pens and magnets. And my brother had the Space Camp pendant flag on his wall next to like a low and brown neon beer sign. We had like endless amounts of Mickey Mouse ornaments from the release of Fantasia. I think each clamshell came with like, must have been 20 of these ornaments or something. So we had a Christmas tree that was like just those ornaments. It's very strange. Most of the posters, though, they just went in the dollar bin. And if you remember the dollar bin, it was a hellish box crammed full of rolled up posters that they would write in Sharpie on the side under siege and hope that the person would realize that poster is just a giant Seagal head with a tiny little battleship. You're probably not going to pay a dollar for it. But what people would do is take the rubber band off, look at the poster, and then try to cram it back in the box. It was the bane of existence for anyone that worked in a video store that had a dollar bin. But it was also the only way we could make sense out of the sheer amount of staggering promotional materials we were receiving. The hope, of course, was that these companies were thinking we would make a display and then someone would want to rent Troma's War. They didn't. The space, though, is quite limited, especially in a mom-and-pop shop. So the bigger titles are what's going up on the wall, you know? Kevin Costner's Field of Dreams is going up. Sorry, Cafe Flesh, but you're just not going to make the cut. Buttons, blow-up baseball bats, mobiles. In case you're wondering, collectors, I kept none of it. None of it. I know. I regret all of that, mostly. I'm just not a pack rat. I wish I had all those things. I wish I could list them on eBay for you, but I just sadly, I cannot. Which this rambling intro somehow brings us to today's episode. The film is Who's Killing the Great Chefs of Europe? The guest is a great chef, and this is VHS. Hello, and welcome to VHS. I'm your host, Dirk Marshall, and I'm joined in the studio by Aaron Barnett, who's a chef.
At times, I mean.
Okay. Well, thank you for being here. You are the chef at St. Jack in Portland, Oregon. L'Amour in Portland, Oregon. I'll stop saying Portland, Oregon, because they're all in Portland, Oregon.
They're all in Portland, Oregon, yeah.
And Scotch Lodge.
Yes.
Okay, and if people are looking for those restaurants, they can go to the websites. St. Jack is just spelled STJACKPDX. L'Amour, PDX, and Scotch Lodge, all one word, .com. Instagram and Twitter are also St. Jack PDX, L'Amour PDX, and I didn't check, but I'm guessing Scotch Lodge PDX?
That's it.
Okay, great. So my first question for you is, you can't possibly be at all these locations, so how does it work for you having all of these restaurants?
Well, I think a huge portion of the thing is like learning at some point how to give up control.
Yeah.
And allowing other people to grow into positions where they can help take care of things when you're not around. So okay. I'm always working, you know, I'm always at one of the restaurants.
Yeah.
All the time. Sometimes I'm at one during the day or two during the day and another at night, but I work service pretty much every night. But I'm lucky enough to have, you know, management staff from our GMs at all the locations to the people who are in charge of the kitchens, the chef de cuisines at those restaurants as well. So those are all people who I've worked with for, you know, relatively long periods of time at all the restaurants. So they have, you know, tons of liberty with the menu and we work together on things. And so I'd love to say it's all me, but, you know, at this point it's me working with people, you know, all the time. So,
right. Yeah. And that's one of my questions. I think it's fascinating to learn about the restaurant world from the people that I know who are chefs and things, because there's different sort of builds, I guess, for them. There's different stages or different, not stages, there's different places.
Like,
yeah, exactly. Or in like how they work. And for someone like yourself that has multiple different places that are doing different, I mean, it's your food, but there's different versions of it, I guess. Would you say that? I mean, L'Amour is different than St. Jack, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think when I came up cooking, I thought I was going to be the next Thomas Keller. And I worked at 3 Michelin star restaurants and mobile 5-star restaurants and that kind of a thing. And obviously I don't do that now, but I learned a lot along the way. You know, one of the restaurants I worked at, we used a lot of weird seafood and we used a lot of Asian ingredients.
Okay.
So I kind of fell in love with those from an early age. All the restaurants I worked at had kind of a French backbone.
Mm-hmm.
St. Jack originally was actually going to be a kind of just whatever I felt like restaurant. So it wasn't going to be focused on French cuisine or anything like that.
Okay.
So I have experience in a lot of different types of cooking. But when I decided to open St. Jack, I just thought, you know, Pascal Sattel, who was the chef at Carafe for many years, became a really big, a really good friend of mine. And he was like a big fan of St. Jack and what we were doing there. Carafe was kind of just on its way. I think we kind of opened, I think, the year or two after they were, right before they were about to close.
Yeah.
And he was one of my biggest proponents. And so, you know, he was just really excited to see French food being done again. And I thought it was a good way to continue that going forward. Of course, I found out, like, I was so buried in the build out that I had no idea what was going on in the outside world. And I found out that Gabe Rucker was opening Little Bird at the exact same time.
Oh, yeah.
Which was hugely alarming to me. Because I was like this no-name guy and, you know, it was always a Gabe Rucker.
Yeah.
But when we opened, it wound up being a good thing. And I thought, you know, having a few French places opening up at the same time was actually really good for us. It gave us something to work towards and to be better than and, you know, or whatever, you know, like to try and compete with some big boys and do something fun at the same time.
Well, I also feel like in a food town like Portland, we'll meet a ton of people that have hot sauce companies or whatever.
Sure.
And they're all doing something different. So it's not like you're both going to be making the exact same menu.
No, and like I think I even told Gabe this one day. It was like I wouldn't go to Little Bird. And not because I didn't like him or didn't like the restaurant. I just didn't want to go there because I thought I'd be judgmental or I thought I'd, you know, I immediately saw the worst in myself when I go to something like that, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I went and I had a fantastic meal and it was not at all what I expected. It was nothing like what I do.
Right.
And so I was so happy that that was the case. It took a load off of me. It made me feel a lot better. But yeah, I mean, getting back to like why all the restaurants kind of have a different thing going on is there's a lot of different things in my head that I want to do. And I can't do them all through one outlet, right? Like if I was to start doing weird modern stuff through St. Jack, it would alienate our customer base. It would kind of go against our concept. It wouldn't make sense, you know? So for me, I was able to the last few years go to France quite a bit and see what these guys are doing over there. And sort of falling in love with different aspects of it, whether it's old school rustic or whether it's new and modern or whatever it might be. And so this is kind of a way for me to explore all those different things. Lamoule, I get to get a little bit more global, you know, it doesn't all have to be French all the time. St. Jack, rustic and modern French. We've kind of started hybridizing that a little bit over the years. And then, you know, with Scotch Lodge, it was just more of an exercise in like, trying to do a zero waste kitchen, using a lot of things that are kind of more intriguing to me, using Asian ingredients, but not in obvious ways, using ingredients that might not be expected in a bar, you know, kind of elevating these things and also keeping the price point. Like, so working on a menu that isn't expensive, but is also really forward thinking and pretty labor intensive, but only maybe 3 things on a plate. You know, but each thing we focus so much attention on each individual component. So,
yes.
And then having the guys and girls that I work with be able to have that same vision, you know, and then working alongside with them and seeing them kind of grow and develop as well has been like hugely rewarding. You know, it's massive for me.
It's one of the things I love about speaking to chefs is that the culinary arts, I love a mentor. I love any time where there's like people that people look up to. A lot of times chefs have their person or their guy that they were like, oh, this was the person that imparted some wisdom to me. And then you see a need within them to do the same thing for other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's never a bad thing to see.
Yeah. Yeah. I think at some point you also have to come to that role.
Right.
I think that takes some time as like and maturity. You know, I think when I was young, I was nobody's mentor. I was an asshole. I yelled and screamed a lot. I was kind of a crazy person. You know, but that was because I didn't feel like I was in control of anything. I was too young, you know, and nervous and worried. And as I started to gain confidence and started to kind of develop, you know, kind of a style, if you will, or whatever, it I became more comfortable. And that's, I think, where you have to get into that role of being able to be like, okay, I'm more of a teacher now. You know, yeah. I'm more of a guy who's here to like help other people and watch them grow and progress. And,
yeah.
You know, you see the number of places that have spun off from St. Jack over the years.
And another, you know, St. Jack is coming.
You're proud of it. Yeah. 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 Actually, that's coming up about a year and a bit. Yeah.
Wow. So,
should be it's yeah there's a lot of stuff going on, but it's good. You know, I mean, growth is good. It keeps me busy, and mm-hmm. you know, at some point, you know, I've never had a job this long before in one position as like the chef at St. Jack, for example.
Most
people don't last, you know, kind of 9 years in that, in one role, unless they own it. And,
yes.
and so I'm kind of, it's nice to be able to branch out and do different things and see it kind of flourish in that way. So that, for me, I feel incredibly fortunate that people want us to be doing things like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. Well, and Sarah and I absolutely adore your food and the environments that you create. We always, because we're luckily friends with people that work in restaurants and things, mm-hmm. there's something so great to see them build a community inside the restaurant so that you can tell everybody cares about what's going on within those walls.
Yeah.
And we love to sit at the pass because sometimes you can hear the servers and stuff talk to each other. And in your restaurants, it's always like people either offering assistance or checking in, or mm-hmm. and it's just great that you've created these environments. And we've gotten to know some people that have worked there,
yeah,
like
yeah.
Valerie, and So I just think it's great that you've built those things.
Well, that's part of opening places too, is giving people who should have opportunities,
yeah.
opportunities, right? So. You know, you mentioned Valerie. So Valerie was our assistant manager at St. Jack.
Mm-hmm.
And she became, in my mind, the perfect go-to for the new general manager when we opened Le Moule, right? Mm-hmm. Elise Walker was our sous chef at St. Jack. And she did not start out at Le Moule, but a year in, I brought her over to be the chef de cuisine there. Tim Hartel, who's running the kitchen over at Scotch Lodge, was my lead line cook at St. Jack for the last
yeah.
couple of years. And so it's all just been a matter of finding these people, you know, and caretaking them.
And what is the chain of, like, so you are executive chef?
Yeah.
And then there is the person that's there at the restaurant that's cooking when you're not there.
Yeah, so Ben Morris runs our kitchen over at St. Jack. He's been okay. there for about a year and a half. Before that, he was at Le Moule as our sous chef.
Okay.
Incredibly talented, hardworking guy. Smart, funny. He's definitely going to have a big career ahead of him.
I'd probably recognize him
yeah.
if he was at Le Moule before.
Yeah, yeah. He would have been working in that middle station there for about 9 months before I moved him over to St. Jack.
Okay, cool.
Anyway, you know, and so, yeah, there's me, and then there's the chef de cuisine. So
chef de cuisine, okay.
Right, so chef de cuisine is Elise over mm-hmm. at Le Moule, and Tim at Scotch Lodge, and Ben at St. Jack. And so then after that, you've got sous chefs.
Right.
And then after that, you've got usually a lead line cook.
Okay.
And then after that, you've got line cooks.
And so you don't have, like, I know, like back in the Taylor Railworks, I think they had someone that worked the fryer, someone that worked like the grill, someone that did raw. Are those
no,
different stations?
They're all different stations.
Okay, so that's not their title. That's
no.
just they're just manning those stations.
I run the kitchens a little bit differently.
Okay.
You'll see a lot of chefs who run kitchens where like you work a station for a year before you move on or however long. I never really do that. I like to see people progress and how they progress, and so then I move them along. So like at St. Jack, for example, no matter who you are or what experience you've got, you know, I mean, I had a guy who was the chef de cuisine at one of the most famous restaurants in the country who came and worked for us, you know, for about a year. And it's like everybody else, he started out working pantry. He started out working salads. And it's not because I don't trust you with the food. It's because it gives you an outlook on the kitchen and how the kitchen operates and works and the tempo, how things are, what's expected of you, the communication levels that go on. You know, on a busy, busy night, St. Jack can do 280 covers, and we only have 5 people in the kitchen. So a lot of places that have the type of food that we do and serve that many people will have 8 or 9 people in the kitchen. So there's a way that we do things and a level of communication that's very different from a lot of other places.
Okay.
So that's why. But yeah, everybody moves around at their own pace. So if we feel like somebody's progressing faster, then we move them forward. And we don't even really treat it as a moving forward thing. We actually will have different people working different stations every few nights just to kind of keep them fresh, because we do have a lot of people. Luckily, I don't lose people too often.
Yeah.
And when we do, oftentimes they come back. So when that happens, you know, these are people I know and I trust and I like, and we want to make sure that they're engaged.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a boring job sometimes. You know, it's really repetitive. So yeah. It's like if somebody's not challenging you, and not meaning like me just beating you up, making sure that you're doing it perfectly every night, but actually keeping you interested in this thing and learning stuff. That's the big thing, is learning stuff, because cooks get bored so quickly.
Yeah, I can't imagine, but I'm also not a cook. So I did want to list some of my favorite dishes. Mm. At Scotch Lodge, the tartare is amazing.
Yeah.
But the octopus dish,
right,
and I'll put a picture of this up on the website, is the best octopus dish I've ever had. And Sarah and I even thought that it was onion that was the charred component at the time of this recording.
Mm-hmm.
Underneath the octopus, but it's potato.
Mm-hmm.
And that's crazy because it looks
like an onion, right?
It looks like an onion.
Yeah.
And then there's a green sauce in there. Mm-hmm. And of course, anytime there's a sauce, we're interested.
And it's a jalapeno sauce.
And it's so good.
It's right up your alley.
Yeah. So that dish, I mean, that's amazing.
Well, that one's just a riff. And that was actually not anything to do with me. That was all Tim.
Oh, really?
That was one of the dishes that when we started talking about doing the menu that he was really, really obsessed with and
yeah.
he really wanted to do.
I almost didn't order it because we were just like, it's octopus.
Whatever,
it's octopus. I mean, we've had octopus. And then we saw it because we were sitting at the,
right.
Chef counter, saw someone get it. Mm-hmm. And Sarah was like, we should probably get that.
Well, it's kind of an interpretation on like a classic Spanish dish. There's like potatoes, peppers, and octopus, right? So same idea.
Yeah.
It's just like that potato situation underneath is way more labor intensive.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, you've got a different contrasting texture of potato on top, and then you've got the bright, bright, bright sauce that
yep.
isn't overly spicy.
No.
It's made with jalapenos.
Yeah.
And the octopus, you know, we've kind of, we dicked around with different ways of getting it as tender as we wanted
mm-hmm.
without kind of mangling it and screwing up the texture. So,
yeah.
And yeah, I think Tim, you know, he's one of those people who's like very particular and,
yeah.
and has a very specific attention to detail. And that's why I think that dish came out as well as it did.
Yeah, it was. It's.
If I had done it, it would have been really half-assed.
Okay. and then at at Le Moule.
Uh-huh.
So the frites with curry ketchup.
Yeah.
Is, I mean, the fries, they're the best fries
Thank
that
you.
We've ever had. Sarah and I are not fry people, so it's one of those things where you have something, where you try it and you're like, oh, this is why I'm not a fry person, because
yeah.
they're not this.
Yeah.
They're always absolutely perfect. And then you put this like little bit of herb and a citrus peel.
Yeah, it's just gremolata. It's parsley, lemon zest, and garlic.
But that little bit of acid is
yeah.
like what wakes up the whole thing. And then we yeah. like to get the curry ketchup, but it's one of our, we'll go there for a snack. Like we'll go and just
mm-hmm.
get a cocktail.
And some fries.
And some fries.
Yeah.
And we would never do that anywhere else. So, and the cocktail is, of course, the Golden Girl.
Yeah, yeah.
Who's responsible for the Golden Girl?
Anna Moss.
Okay.
So she was our bar manager for a long time. She's yeah. now over at Eam.
Okay.
But that was her drink, yeah.
Man, that is...
It is a good one.
It's so good.
Yeah.
At St. Jack, the steak tartare.
Okay.
You can see a pattern for
you
us.
You seem to like raw meat.
We like raw meat
All
a
right.
lot. Sometimes we'll go to our friend's restaurant and only get things that aren't cooked, which is strange.
I mean, ironically, I'm sitting here looking at vampire posters over
right.
the corner, so it all makes sense.
I know. That's the Lost Boys Lounge. And then the crab and fava salad.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which, I mean.
Again, that's you know, that was a dish. That's Ben's dish, the crab and fava. That was one that he came up with using my patented ranchovy.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, that was one that we started working on years and years ago with my old chef de cuisine, Amanda. And she and I would work on different dressings. And one day we were talking and I was just like, the two best dressings in the world are hands down like ranch and Caesar.
Yeah.
And so we figured out how to blend the two into kind of like a happy marriage of like a buttermilk anchovy
sure.
dill situation. And it works so well with like crab and soft
yeah.
herbs and peas and things like that. It's just
yeah.
like this perfect kind of yummy, not too goopy, you know, kind of vinaigrette. And so, yeah, that's where that one came from. And it's such a tricky dish too, because all the leaves and little sprouts and things
yep.
that are on there are so delicate. And they,
mm-hmm.
and they, you know, this time of year, spring, it's like all the vegetables are kind of limp. Like
yes.
they
yeah.
give up quick. So
yeah.
they don't have a long shelf life. So you got to be quick with some of these things and make sure that our farmers are bringing them as fresh as possible and all that. The tartare too, like tartares in general are one of my favorite things.
Oh, they're so good.
I love raw stuff.
Yeah.
You know? So for me, you know, the one at Scotch Lodge, that one we actually incorporated dried mushrooms into,
mm-hmm.
That we rehydrate and do all kinds of stuff with. And, yeah, it's just, it's one of those things where I think we've done classic steak tartares historically, but finding new and fun ways to do it,
yeah,
you know, working with textures and different flavor profiles and all that stuff has been awesome.
And we love a classic one, but if we go somewhere and someone's doing something a little bit different, we have to get it every time. Like, it's just, it doesn't matter if we have too many dishes already picked out, like, we're going to get the tartare or carpaccio, whatever the thing is that they're doing. But we're not here just to talk about your restaurant.
Let's just do it. Want to get the menus out? We can just go through the whole
thing. I would really like to, actually. I get made fun of on the PDX food podcast that I'm on because every time I talk about what chefs are doing with their ingredient, I'm like, Aaron Barnett.
I know, and I get
like,
texts.
Again? And I'm like, I'm sorry, but he is always doing something with local, like, seasonal ingredients, and he texts me back at midnight or whenever I decide that I have to talk to people. But we're also brought together by a film, and that film is Who's Killing the Great Chefs of Europe?
Mm-hmm.
Was this a first-time view for you?
Yeah, I'd never seen it before.
Okay, great. It's a comedy thriller from 1978. The synopsis is, mystery abounds when it's discovered that one by one, the great chefs of Europe are being killed. The intriguing part of the murders is that each chef is killed in the same manner that their own special dish is prepared in. Food critics and the mainly self-proclaimed greatest chefs in Europe demand the mystery to be solved.
Yep.
That's exactly what happens.
And hilarity ensues.
Oh, man. Thriller comedies from the 70s. At the time of this recording, it's only available on DVD, although Xfinity said, I looked it up online, said they could stream it, but I didn't check to see if that's possible. And I believe there is a copy to rent at Movie Madness in Portland. But I chose this for a specific reason, and that being that you're a chef, and they're just killing chefs in this movie. So I thought this is going to be a fantastic conversation. Before we get to that, though, I'd like to put the film in context. So here's just some of the things that some of the players were involved in around the time of the film. First up, we have the director. That's Ted Kotcheff, which has chef in his name.
That's perfect.
Yeah. So I was like, this is...
It was meant to be.
Yeah. It's going to be great. He did Fun with Dick and Jane in 1977, Too Many Chefs, which is the alternate title of this movie. So I think in the States, it was... Too Many Chefs, because maybe they thought, like, well, who's going to care about European chefs here? Chefs. So, and then he did First Blood in 1982.
Did he really?
Yeah.
That's a big jump.
Yes.
Right?
And then Uncommon Valor in 83. And then Weekend at Bernie's in 1989.
That was the opus, though.
Yeah. So I think if you mix First Blood and Weekend at Bernie's, you might get this movie. Possibly.
Less floral shirts.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah.
He's also the executive producer of 263 episodes of Law & Order SVU.
Wow.
So he probably made way more money.
I think my dad's his biggest fan.
Oh, you could be.
Yeah, that might be.
I'll try to get his autograph.
Wow.
The cinematographer, John Alcott, his first credit is lighting cameraman on A Clockwork Orange in 1971.
Oh.
Barry Lyndon in 75, Too Many Chefs in 78, The Shining in 80. Terror Train in 80. Those are both, they're both horror movies, yeah. Fort Apache, The Bronx in 81, Vice Squad in 82, and The Beastmaster in 82.
Wow.
Yes.
I saw that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I have all three. And then Baby, Secret of the Lost Legend in 1985, which if you remember it, it's the most terrible dinosaur movie.
That one?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I remember that one.
And there's some bad dinosaur movies, but I think at the time, definitely in 1985, it was...
I feel like that was in my VHS player
when I was a kid. The most disappointing. Like, it's got the least, like, articulated points of movement. Like, you're just like, that is really bad. The editor is Tom Noble. He's a beast, so I just picked, like, some of the films at random. Fahrenheit 451 in 66, Too Many Chefs in 78, Red Dawn in 84.
Jeez.
Yeah, Witness in 85, Poltergeist 2, The Other Side in 86, Exorcist 3 in 90, Thelma and Louise in 91, Body of Evidence in 93, Mask of Zorro in 98.
Yeah, there you go.
And Inspector Gadget in 99.
Sick.
And just keeps on going.
Yeah.
So I just love to, like, list these off because it's like, I never heard of this movie. And then you realize, like, oh, I've seen so many things that all of these people have done and never knew this existed.
These are long careers.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, gosh.
That's like 30-some years.
Oh, yeah. It's crazy. The actor, George Segal, he did so much that I'm not going to list off. It's crazy. His credits start in the 60s, and I don't think there's a year he didn't work.
No.
So just some of them. Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf in 66, California Split in 74, Fun with Dick and Jane in 77, Too Many Chefs in 78, which means he did back-to-back with Ted. So that's pretty cool. Last married couple in America in 80. Look Who's Talking in 89.
Yes.
Flirting with Disaster in 96. And The Cable Guy in 96.
Okay.
I stopped there, but it keeps going.
It keeps going.
Then we got, of course, Jacqueline Bisset. She's a detective in 68. Bullet in 68. Airport in 70. Murder on the Orient Express, which means she really loves these like thriller mysteries, you know. 74. Too Many Chefs in 78, for which she was nominated for a Golden Globe.
Really?
Yeah. So people did watch this movie.
Golden Globe.
A Golden Globe.
Okay.
Which I don't know how that works, but and then Wild Orchid in 89, which I have to list because my dad had it in his video store and I watched it a lot as a kid. Then another actor, we have Robert Morley. He's the last one I'll list. He's the larger man. That's the food critic. He did a ton of work, a lot of theater, TV, especially in the UK. But most people, in the States at least, would recognize him for being...
His eyebrows.
Yes. And the great, he was in The Great Muppet Caper in 81.
Yep.
And Oh Heavenly Dog in 1980, in which Chevy Chase is resurrected as a dog.
Yeah.
And he solves, I believe he solves his own murder.
I feel like that's actually what happened in that
movie.
Oh
my gosh.
Okay.
Yeah. So... Anyway, those are some of the players that are involved in Too Many Chefs or Who's Killing the Greatest Chefs in Europe. What we don't get in the film is how these people came to become chefs. So what I'd like to ask you is how you even found your way to being a chef.
Well.
Was it in Canada?
No. Well, I guess, right? Like, so I was born in a really small town in, in the middle of Canada. And my dad was always a big fan of French food. So when we did go out for special occasions or whatever, it was always to sort of fancy French restaurants. He loved fancy French restaurants.
Wow.
And this is back in the, you know, mid 80s, early 80s. And that's so everybody was, there was still like white glove service and like Gyrodons coming out and people lifting cloches off of things and
what's
people carving stuff.
Gyrodon?
Gyrodon's like a cart.
Oh, really cart.
Yeah, a little really cart. They're usually pretty fancy, though.
Yeah, Gyrodon sounds fancy.
I know these things.
Does it have drawers with utensils and things?
Oftentimes, and so there was all these different things going on, and these were restaurants that were called, like, Dubrovnik's or the Velvet Glove.
And they sound like sex clubs.
They could be maybe underground. I don't know. But it was all really old-school French food.
Okay.
And so I grew up eating a fair amount of that. My family's all from Scotland, so we ate a lot of like braises and things like that all the time, stews and whatever, just because we were in the middle of Canada, it was cold, and they were cooking a lot of like cultural stuff. But when we went out, it was usually to nicer places. We moved down to California when I was sixth grade, probably. And I think we, at that point, we'd never really had decent Mexican food. We'd never really had Southeast Asian food.
Mm-hmm.
We'd never really had a ton of really good Indian food. And moving down to LA just changed that completely. My mom fell in love with all the different flavors that were like lighter and brighter, and all the herbs and spicy stuff. And so,
was your dad bummed?
No, he still pulled out the Gyrodon every once in a while. But they were just so in love with that stuff that we started kind of really experimenting with different dishes. I started learning to cook when I was really young, and so basically, as things moved on, you know, I didn't really think much about it. You turn into a teenager, at which point you're just like shoveling boxes of macaroni and cheese in your face and just
Doritos.
Yeah, and just being gross. And then as you get older, I think I graduated high school pretty early. I was young and I went to university and that was a bad idea.
Wait, how early? Are you like Doogie Howser?
No, if I was Doogie Howser, I definitely wouldn't be cooking for a living. I was like 16.
Oh, okay.
So but it was just too young to go to school. And so I off away from home and doing the whole thing. I turned into kind of a monster for a bit there. Came back. I was 19 and I wanted to go to culinary school. And my folks were like, no, I don't think that's a good idea. They'd prefer me to get like, you know, a job that was a real job.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I was kind of a lazy kid and just kind of floated around. I worked in vet clinics. And then I decided I was going to become a veterinarian.
Ooh, wait.
Yeah, I was
How
actually
did you end up in a vet clinic?
I was on my way to becoming a veterinarian. So when I dropped out, the first job I got was a buddy of mine's dad owned a pet store. So Buff's Pets and More. And so his name was Buff. And
Buff's Pets and More.
Yeah, yeah. And so I became kind of the lackey at Buff's Pets and More when I was 19.
My dad's video store that I grew up in was called VCRs and More.
It was a theme.
But then you'll like this. When they added movies, because initially people just rented VCRs and camcorders.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And then when VHS happened, It's like, well, they got to know there's movies. So we called it VCRs and More plus Movies. So it had more in the middle, which you don't usually see.
I like that a lot.
Yeah.
That's good. Yeah, so I worked at this pet store. I wound up that one of the veterinarians from a local vet clinic would come in all the time to buy like little baby mice for his snakes.
Oh, good.
And I was always the one who would get them for him, start chatting with him and whatever. Anyway, one day he was like, you know, we're looking for somebody to help out as like a entry-level veterinary technician at the vet clinic. And I was like, you know, I was like cleaning stalls and doing gross stuff.
Yeah.
Wrestling large dogs down because all the other vet techs were like tiny little women. And then there was just like me. So every time a giant dog would come in, I'd be like, Aaron. And then
did you have to wear a singlet or you just wrestled them in street
clothes?
Oh,
no. I had really cute scrubs.
Oh gosh.
Cause everybody bought like fancy scrubs. And yeah. So I was buying like camo scrubs and ones with like a million howling wolves
Whoa.
All over it and lightning skate. Anyway.
Wow.
Yeah. I had a thing going there. And so I worked my way up. Eventually, I was doing minor surgeries and assisting in full blown surgeries, doing large animal work, going out into the polo fields and working with horses and all that kind of stuff, and really fell in love with it. And the veterinarians were trying to get me to go back to school for it because they felt like I had an aptitude for it.
Yeah.
So I did. And then I realized that I am shit at math and I am shit at science. And getting into vet school is harder than getting into med school. So
really?
There's usually only one vet school per state, if that. So it's a very small number of people who are able to go. And to get in, you have to have grades that are just through the roof. And I definitely didn't. So
no, I wouldn't have hacked it.
No. So it just wasn't my thing. I was good at the hands-on stuff. But when it came to actually in the, you know, organic chemistry and all these different things, I was just like lost. At that point, I'd been going back to school off and on and doing all this stuff. And finally, my parents were like, fine, fuck it. Go to school. Go to culinary school and do this thing. And suddenly I went and I was like dean's list and I was like with honors and I was like the number one guy in the class. And I felt and I was like working harder than I'd ever worked in my life. And I was like really into it. And I already knew a lot of the stuff, which is nice because of my parents, you know, with all the food stuff growing up. And so, I mean, we used to watch PBS cooking shows all day long. Like when I would get off school, that's what we did.
Yeah.
You know, and so it was just like, I knew a lot about it. And so graduated. I wound up finding a restaurant that I wanted to go to. I did a bunch of research on the restaurant I wanted to do my externship at. And I wound up going to a mobile five-star restaurant in Canada in Vancouver, which is called Lumiere. At the time, it was all 8 to 15 course tasting menus. And I started and I was just doing garbage work and I worked my way up and eventually wound up, just doing really well with it. And I was working 6 days a week, usually 12 to 13 hours a day.
Is this which, more like traditional French?
No. This was like
okay,
kind of forward thinking.
Okay.
A lot of Asian influence, a lot of, it was very ticky-tacky, tiny little plates. Yeah, everything was very
precious. I mean, not knowing, so I have to ask, is that a huge crossover, the French, like, Asian fusion thing? Because I've seen, like, you know, Jean-Georges and some people, yeah. And I just didn't know if that was a wider thing that I wasn't aware of.
It happened in phases, right? Like, in the 90s, that was a big point in time where that stuff started to happen. You'd see places like Wolfgang Puck with Spago, right? He started incorporating, like, he was using French techniques, but he was doing, like, Asian things and he was using Mexican ingredients or using, you know, his famous, you know, he's made a pizza out of smoked salmon and creme fraiche and stuff, right? So they were all sort of...
So 90s.
Yeah, I know. It's so good, though. Yeah. You ever had it?
No.
Dude, have it. It's really? So fucking good. Yeah,
okay.
I mean, there's a reason it was an emblematic dish.
Yeah.
You know, and you can look at food and, you know, I make jokes to my staff all the time if they plate something and I'm like, that is beautiful in 1984.
Yeah.
But like,
a great tuna tower.
Yeah, exactly. But that's the thing is like, you know, knowing where this food comes from and being able to kind of pick and choose how you want to make food based on all this kind of breadth of time and knowledge. But the Asian thing, that was Chinoiserie, Jean-Georges. He was kind of the forefront of that. But it's an easy amalgamation. And I think it became almost like what, like that sort of molecular gastronomy was, where you had like some people who were killer at it.
Yeah.
And then a bunch of people just learned a little bit enough to get by and make some foam.
Yeah.
And then the foam tasted like garbage.
Yep.
You know, but these guys actually know how to make it really good.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the same sort of thing that happened with the Chinoiserie movement or like the sort of Asian fusion, I think, thing that was happening is you had a lot of people who were just doing wasabi mashed potatoes and miso glazed salmon.
Right.
Right. Another sort of emblematically totally like bad dish. Before, yes. Yeah. Everybody's had that of a certain age, you know, yes. Like, and so those were all things that I think, yeah, it was at that point in time, this was probably early aughts, maybe 2003 when I was working there. Okay. And we were lucky because we were able to work with, I'm sure some of the characters in this movie who they were based on, like the Rue brothers, who were very, very famous.
Yeah.
Santi Santa Maria, who was this very huge figure in Spanish cooking. A lot of really interesting French guys that would come through the kitchen. We'd be able to work with them and learn from them.
Wow.
But the Asian thing was something that was, I liked how they were doing it because it was delicate and mm-hmm. it wasn't obvious. Mm-hmm. They were just using these ingredients like any other. So yeah. They weren't trying to recreate an Asian dish.
That's something that I've really appreciated about your food is that, like, first of all, if there's a sauce involved, I know it's going to be amazing. And you've told me before about, like, you know, just building sauces and taking mm-hmm. time as an important ingredient in yeah. sauces, building them up and everything. And what kept us from going to St. Jack initially, way before Lemuel, I think. How long did you have St. Jack before Lemuel opened?
Five years.
Yeah, so for a long time, was that we both thought we didn't like French bistros
mm-hmm.
because we had gone to one and everything was like super heavy and just kind of clunky.
Yeah.
Like we were saying about the gremolata on the fries that you do, there was nothing that was like that acidity note of things, you know?
And that's the trick with heavy food. My food isn't light. I mean, it's still pretty heavy, but I fool you into thinking it's not.
Yeah. Well, and it also tastes like luxurious. It doesn't taste like I don't know the wording for it exactly, but like I said, clunky. It doesn't taste like paste if there's a creamy sauce.
I'm so glad that my food doesn't taste like paste.
Yes.
Because that would be a bummer. You know,
right. Like, it's, well, I mean, it's like trying to talk wine without the right vocabulary.
No, it's all a matter of like screwing around with acid, fat, texture.
Yes.
And then compartmentalizing and separating different ingredients out. Mm-hmm. Right. Like all my staff know that I hate stew. I hate it, right? Like if
too many stews
or a bowl
as a kid.
Of chili or whatever.
Right.
One, you know, you take two bites of it.
It all is the same.
And it's just, you're just eating at that point. First couple bites are super yummy, right?
Right.
But like what I like to do is I like to have a dish that when you eat it, every bite is going to have a little different thing.
Right? Yeah.
So you're going to have things like, even if I do a braised dish, you're going to have like maybe a cipollini onion that's been caramelized and then deglazed with honey and sherry vinegar five times
right.
before it goes into that dish. So you're going to have some things that are going to be bright and acidic, some things that are fresh, some things that are cooked heavily. And then, you know, you're acidulating like lots of lemon. We go through so many lemons in the kitchen, like as we're finishing dishes, the pastas get tons of lemon. Everything gets tons of lemon because you have to bring it out of the mire and make it not so pasty.
You had a dish at Lemuel that was like a mushroom fettuccine mm-hmm. dish. I think it may have returned to the menu in some form recently, but I could be wrong.
We got a spatzel on right now.
That's amazing though. But we went when Sarah's brother was in town so we could order more food
mm-hmm.
than just for two people. And it was amazing.
Good.
Like, and it didn't feel like a huge gut bomb. Like sometimes like a fettuccine Alfredo,
yeah.
you're just like, you get a couple bites in and you're like, what are we all doing? Oof. This is
right. Yeah.
Not right.
No, I mean, we used to do a foie gras fettuccine and you'd imagine that would be,
yes.
that would just put you to bed. Right.
Uh-huh.
And it was foie gras, cream, butter, mushrooms, shitloads of Madeira.
Yeah.
And that was the sauce. And it was creamy and rich and velvety, but it never came off heavy. You know, and that's the tricky thing is trying to figure that out. So, but that's part of what I do. You
right.
know, and like we've got guys, you know, my sous chef Tony, I'd put him up against any saucier in the country at this point, like with how his ability to balance flavors, make pan sauce. I mean, he's got a world of knowledge that he's been with me for, I guess, 3.5 years, 4 years. But like he knows more about classic French cooking and sauce building
mm-hmm.
than most people I know. Like he's incredibly talented with that.
Plus he's got a frisky title.
He does.
Saucier. It doesn't get friskier than that.
Saucier.
Uh-huh. And so what brought you to Portland in this chef world? Is that a big jump from 2003?
No, I was working in Vancouver, BC, and my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, is American. And she was very politely by the Canadian government asked to leave the country when her visa was gone. So we had to move. We started looking at different places to move to. We were looking at, like, because I was looking mostly for my career stuff. Mm-hmm. And so we're looking at, like, New York, Chicago, San Francisco, and Atlanta, ironically, because there was a restaurant down there with a chef named Gunter Seeger, who I really had a big crush on, and mm-hmm. I wanted to go and work for him. But we didn't move to any of those places. We wound up moving to San... Well, we actually did. We moved to San Francisco. So okay. I was hired in San Francisco, okay. where I maintained and continued working at sort of that level. At a restaurant called Gary Danko. And I worked my way up to the saucier there, which is where I kind of got hard into sauces.
Okay.
So learned a lot about that, learned a lot about consistency. Lumiere was a bit more freewheeling. Gary Danko was very structured. I'm not a hugely structured guy, so it was a challenging environment for me. But I think if you ask any of those guys I used to work with, I was probably the loudest guy in the kitchen. goofiest.
This wasn't when you were angry and yelling.
Oh, I was angry and yelling, yeah.
What do you think is the most ridiculous word that you yelled in the kitchen?
Well, there have been a few.
Bucatini?
No, I make up a lot of yells sometimes, too. And I'll make up names for some of the dishes that when I call them out. And no one, I mean, if you go to the restaurants, you'll hear me making noises, but you're never really sure what I'm saying. The cooks all know. And a lot of times they think it's funny.
Nice. a lot of times.
Poutine is...
Poutine?
It's a poutine at St. Jack, but it's the poutinesca mussels at...
Oh.
Yeah. So I've got to keep it... keep my shit correct.
I mean, if they travel from one to the other restaurant, they might be...
Yeah. It gets very confusing. Calling for runners. No one ever knows what I'm calling for hands or runners or runner please or hot food runner. I make up words. I also just make noises sometimes, loud hollers.
And, just because you can.
Yeah.
But this isn't angry, though.
No, the angry stuff, those were never fun. Right. And the words that came out of my mouth were chosen very...
Right.
They were very specific words. They weren't kind. This was also, at a time when you didn't have to be as nice as you do now.
Sure.
I was a terrible human being. And I did a lot. I said a lot of nasty things to a lot of people and made a lot of people upset and a lot of people cry. And
oh, dear.
But I was broke and working too much. And
yeah.
I was, you have this person who's telling you that if you make one mistake, you're fired.
Right.
So you have a lot of pressure. And it was challenging. So,
and what led you from that to be how you are today?
Well, by nature, I'm not that way.
Yeah. Right?
So
it just came out in the environment.
Yeah. So if you talk to any of these guys I used to work with, I used to work with this guy named Dennis Peckham up in Vancouver. And he was one of the loudest and funniest human beings you'll ever meet. And he taught me to cook, like legitimately. He was the guy who stood next to me, and he was the one I
had to be. He's the guy. We found the guy.
I had to be his teammate, right? Like I was his partner on the station. Mm-hmm. So if I didn't hold my weight, then he went down. And he had a way of making me work harder, not by screaming at me or yelling at me or treating me like shit, but by making fun of me.
Right.
And by making jokes all the time. And I was like, I hate this. I hate being belittled like this. Like, it was so fucking frustrating. So I would get so angry. And, like, he would do this thing because I'm a sweater. I'm a sweater on the line. I sweat.
Okay.
And so, like, I'd be sitting there just dying. And he made it look effortless. And I was just dying. And I'm, like, trying my best to keep up. And I'd have sweat all over my forehead. And he would just sit there. And I would just feel his dirty tan towel dab my forehead. And I lost it so many times about him doing that. He thought it was great. But he was one of the, he's still one of the funnier guys I know. But he was the guy that taught me how to work forward and remain somewhat positive.
Yeah.
Still have that level of energy and like have that sort of, have people never quite know what's going to come out of you.
Mm-hmm.
And not have to be cruel.
Yeah.
About it. Like there was a lot of off color stuff and there was a lot of rude stuff and there was a lot of like shit talking, but it was by and large all in good fun. And so as I got older, again, once you start getting more comfortable in who you are and what you're doing, then I kind of calmed down. Now I have kind of like a Jewish grandmother sense of guilt. I also do talk a lot of shit. I make fun of my cooks quite a bit if they screw up. And
but you're creating a fun environment.
It's far more familial.
Yeah. That's what we picked up on. That's why I mentioned it.
Yeah, it's like, and I also have to know, like, as a manager, you can't it's not like the old days. You can't just scream at a room and everybody's going to respond the same way.
Well, so. And they certainly wouldn't come back to work for you.
No.
And they are coming back. So.
Yeah, I've got a number of people who went off and then asked if they could come back, you know, like a year later or whatever.
Sarah and I knew that you were one of our people when, I don't know if it's when we met or had like a first conversation, and it was at the Nikki USA Wild About game, and you were plating, I think it was a tartar or something. It was outside.
I don't remember.
It was a couple years ago.
Oh, venison. Yeah, it was a venison poke.
Yeah, that's what it was. Yeah. It was great. And you were like, well, you guys have been into St. Jack. And we were like, no, we haven't. And you just said, you fuckers, just right there. And we were like, oh, he's like a real person. This is one of our people. Because there was just not a pretense or any. You were just, it was just a great moment that we enjoy a lot.
Oh, good.
So thanks for
not being a dick.
Yeah. And calling us fuckers, I guess.
I actually, my assistant manager came up to me the other day and she was like, I'd said something super rude to one of my servers.
Yeah.
And it was in jest, though. You know, like it wasn't meant to be.
Sure.
And I've known this person for a long time. So it was one of these things where I said something and she just looked at me. She was like, you know, if I said that to anybody, they'd quit. She's like, but with you, everybody is just like, oh, that guy.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it's
kind of great.
It's been a thing since I was a kid, apparently. I'm able to kind of get away with things.
That's awesome.
It is.
But in the film, something happens. And I don't know, maybe you've done this in your various stages of being a chef, but a man spits on another man's pigeon.
Uh-huh.
Have you ever spit on another man's pigeon?
No.
Okay. No. I've never asked that, so that's a fun experience for both of us.
No, I ate some pigeon yesterday, but I didn't spit on anything.
Great.
No.
There's a scene in the movie where a chef is very mad about the quality of mushrooms, and he says, I should have brought my own. How does buying work exactly for like specialty events? And have you ever had a horror story where your mushrooms weren't up to snuff?
Yeah, I mean, you have things like that happen all the time. You know, buying produce or meat or vegetable or whatever, right? Buying any of that stuff is always kind of a crapshoot. You try to find the best people who are going to be able to provide something, and then you stick with those people because they're consistent, they know what they're doing, they treat you fairly, they don't try to like jump prices on you when you're not expecting it. Yeah, you guys work with produce people all the time, so you guys know. There are going to be times when like you get some stuff in, it's just garbage, you know, and you're like, what the hell is this?
You know? Or if you're doing an event somewhere else, you might have to source from
someplace else. Yeah. I mean, I had to do a dinner for the Democratic Governors Association in DC, and I showed up out there and they were like, all the product will be here and ready. And if there's anything you want us to do for you ahead of time, let us know. And I was like, okay, we'll just do this and this and this. And I sent them a couple of recipes, very simple stuff. Impossible. So I thought to fuck up. Totally fucked up when I got there.
Of course.
And all the produce was wrong and everything was wilted and kind of garbagey. And so I had a mini hissy fit because I had literally just gotten off a plane.
Yeah.
And I had, you know, kind of 17 hours to get ready for 800 people by myself.
Oh my gosh.
And it was my first time doing an event out of state and all that kind of stuff. And so I was just losing it. So that was terrible. One of the worst stories.
Wait, what did you do? It worked, apparently.
Oh, yeah. I just killed myself in the process.
There was
nothing really interesting about that except for that I worked basically for that 17-hour period trying to make it happen. And, like, none of their equipment worked. It was the worst event I had ever done. But one of the worst stories that I was a part of was I was working at Gary Danko. And Gary had to go and do an event. And it was an event for a lot of other very high-end famous chefs, and he was doing a foie gras torchon course, and there was one of the kids working at the kitchen who was in charge of making the foie gras torchons to go on this trip.
Okay.
So he packs up all the foie, he makes all these torchons. He made two for us to have in the kitchen for service that night, and then the other ones he was packing up in a cooler and taking away. So they all go into a cooler. Everybody's like flustered and trying to get out the door and get to the
airplane.
And
the torchon is?
It's like a cold foie gras preparation, like a pate. Mm-hmm. And so this guy, so right before service or right as service starts, the person who's working pantry where the foie torchon comes off of, she sliced into it and she tasted it. And she was like, and I was right next to her and I was kind of saucier, so I was kind of high up in the rankings there. And so she was like, does this taste okay? And I tasted it. I was like, whoa, it just tasted like a bouillon cube. Like it was like a salt lick.
No.
And I was like, fuck.
How do you fix that?
So I like cut another piece off. I was like, maybe it's just
Right, one spot.
A place where there's like a lot of salt.
Yeah.
So I cut another piece off and I ate it and I was like, oh shit. So I hollered to the sous chef. The sous chef comes over and tastes it. And we're all looking at each other going like, he's doing this event for like 400 people. He's got like 50 foie torchons in his cooler and he's on an airplane. He hasn't even arrived yet. So.
And it's for chefs.
Yeah. And so the sous chef is like calling the hotel and he's have Gary. And this is before everybody had cell phones too, yes. Right? So he's like, have him call me as soon as he gets in. Have him call me as soon as he gets in. So the minute he got to the hotel, he's like, you need to taste it. And so he tastes it and he's like, what the fuck happened?
Oh
like, but this poor bugger who made the torchon, right?
Yeah.
Is just standing there the entire night. He was a day guy too. He didn't work at night, but he was still there at like 9 o'clock at night, just waiting to hear what the chef had to say. And he was panicking. He was like dead white. Anyway. The chef was a chef. He's a three-star chef. He figured out how to fix it and make it okay, but it was definitely not a good moment.
Oh, that is terrible.
Mm-hmm.
Which brings us to the first death in the film,
mm-hmm.
and it's a pigeon dish.
Yep.
I didn't know what the name was, but is that a real dish?
What was the dish called again?
I don't know.
Okay.
But it did it.
Probably.
Okay.
I mean, the other dishes were all real dishes.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, I just I haven't had a lot of pigeon.
Well, we can go to St. Jack later if you want.
We're
having one special tonight.
Pigeon and pheasant are two things that I just have never really...
Pigeon's easily one of my favorite meats.
Okay.
Easily.
Yeah. David Sapp, who works at mm-hmm. Ponzi, he came over with the family and so the kids could play and everything, and he brought over a pheasant. We were just doing tostadas, but he brought over this pheasant that was like cooked in wine and all kinds of... It was delicious.
Yeah.
But I just don't know a lot about the properties of pigeon or pheasant.
Birds are amazing.
But quail once, maybe.
Quail is one of my other favorites. But pigeon, it's a red meat bird, so like duck, you can eat it rare, medium rare.
Okay.
Very flavorful.
Is it just served on the tiny little pigeon body or like?
It's actually not as small as you might think.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it's the size of like a, what are those tiny chickens called? Cornish game hens.
Okay.
It's about that size.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you just roast it and serve it that way? Or
a bazillion different ways of doing it.
But what's the special?
Tonight we're doing it where I fermented some rice and I mixed that with Worcestershire sauce. So it's kind of like a French miso. And then rub that, let it marinate in that, and then pan roast it. And then we're serving that with, I always forget the name of the sauce. It's like a Spanish sauce made with peppers and almonds. Romesco.
Oh, yeah.
So we're serving it with romesco and a smoked sunchoke puree and some blistered ramps. And demi-glace.
Wow. That sounds awesome.
It is awesome. I liked it. I was really happy with it.
The first time I really laughed in the movie is when the detective says to the lady, could it have been one of the cooks? And she says, that's ridiculous. He would have fired anyone who overcooked meat like that. And she's talking about this person who was like the chef and mm-hmm. he's dead.
Yeah.
And that's her retort. You don't see a lot of these like thriller comedies anymore where they're like balancing and there's major tonal shifts in the film too where it's like this is a funny part and like this is the scary
part. This is a serious part, yeah, yeah.
But I just love that. That's a great moment. And then we get a beautiful fish market scene where they're sourcing, and I was thinking as a chef. When you go to places, I mean, imagine now when you're sourcing, it's just off of lists mostly. You're
typically,
not actually going to, like we see in Japan or something, where they just have these docks lined with all these fish.
It doesn't exist in Portland, sadly.
Yeah.
It does in some places, like in Vancouver, BC, where I worked before, you could go and do that in the mornings.
Yeah.
Los Angeles, you can definitely do that. San Francisco, you can definitely do that. Portland, we just don't have that. So,
yeah.
We have our farmers markets, mm-hmm. but that's about it. So produce we can do... meat, you can go out to the farm, but
sure.
But that's about it. Fishing and fish in general in Portland is always kind of a stressful topic just because for years and years and years, all that was available was farmed trout,
mm-hmm.
salmon, halibut, mussels, clams. And that was pretty much, and sturgeon once in a while or black cod. Those are all we really had to choose from.
Yeah.
And so now we've got more fishermen who are on board with trying to actually get
mm-hmm.
their product into town. And so we're able to see more interesting things popping up. And I think that with our population boom kind of happening here too, we're getting people who kind of want more interesting stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm actually happy to see that happen because the fishermen are going to make out better for it. We get better product and we can pass that on to you guys. So
yeah. I just lost my train of thought about... Oh, because you like weird seafood, you said.
I do.
And I also know that you like offal.
I do. I was thinking about, like, today, in the last 2 days, I've eaten cow's head, pigeon, heart, and pigskin just in the last 24 hours.
Wow, that's impressive.
It is, but it's just it's just how I eat.
It's a good balance because someone's going to just waste those parts anyway.
People think I'm gross. It's fine.
Okay.
You can make it as nice as you want.
So speaking of gross, then we get the duck press scene. Is a duck press a thing?
Yeah, I've eaten it.
It's no. Really good.
Yeah.
Wait, you eat it?
Yeah.
I thought you were just drinking the duck juice.
That is what makes the sauce.
So it just presses.
So you take all the meat off the bone.
Yeah.
Right. So you roast a duck. So this is how it traditionally happens. You roast a whole duck, but you want to keep the breast like rarer.
Okay.
Right. So you can only roast it for about 20 minutes. Then you have to take it out and then you cut the legs off.
Okay.
Then you put them back in some form of oven or some other way to cook them so that they finish cooking, because legs you don't want to have rare. You want to have those cooked through because they're tough.
Okay.
So that has to cook longer. And then once all that's done, there's usually some kind of tableside preparation that happens in advance. Oftentimes with a high-end restaurant like that, what they'll actually do is they'll start out with a spare duck. So that the duck that you're getting,
yeah,
the legs were from the duck prior. Does that make sense?
It's like a Franken-duck.
Well, so the duck leg had time to cook through.
Yeah, of course.
So you'll be presented with a whole duck.
Yeah.
And then at the table, the maitre d' would cut the breast off, right? Slice it, present it, cut the legs off, and then those would go back to the kitchen. But what would happen is moments later, the legs would show back up.
Yeah.
But those were the legs from the previous duck. Those legs that went back to the kitchen are for the next guy.
Whoa.
Right? So there's a whole system for it.
So don't get excited about your duck legs, because you're not going to get those. You're going to get someone else's.
You're getting somebody else's.
Don't be like, ooh.
Used legs. But yeah, so then what they do is then you've got this carcass that still has a fair amount of blood in it, because it's rare, right? So that they whack it up and then they throw it into this giant kind of horrifying, you know,
meat press,
and it's beautiful though. They're gorgeous. They're made out of like sterling silver and all kinds of ornate. Anyway, and then they crank that thing down, and then anything that's left in that duck all comes out as a liquid.
Yeah.
And so that liquid then is typically mounted with demi-glace and butter or booze, like Madeira or brandy or whatever, and then that becomes your sauce for the duck.
But then the stuff that's pressed, they take out of the press and you eat it?
No, that's just.
Okay.
That's just bones.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's what I
thought. You get rid of that.
Okay, good. Perfect. I don't want that. It's terrifying. as far as deaths, we have Kohler, and he's baked. We have Zoppy, which I loved Zoppy, is boiled.
Lobster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I forget what Kohler's dish was.
Steak.
Steak, yeah. Why is it baked then?
Oh, no. No, I was thinking of the other guy.
Zoppy's broiled.
Was Zoppy broiled?
Yeah.
I thought he was the one they found in the lobster tank.
Boiled, sorry.
Right.
Yeah, typo.
One was boiled, one was baked, and one was found in the lobster tank.
Yes. Zoppy's boiled, Kohler's baked. Yeah. Anyway, each murder is...
anyway, yeah. Let's glean over that one.
Anyway, not important.
Yeah.
Each murder is done in the style of their signature dish. So my big question to you is, how would you be killed?
You'd have to cram me into another animal, I think. That's usually
what I'm really? Yeah. Stuffed inside another animal?
Yeah, probably.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, this is all structured around that question to you. But in lieu of you maybe not having an answer, I went to some other people.
Okay.
So Sarah Marshall, my wife of Marshall's Hot Sauce, she said that you'd be shucked, I think, because we go to Lemuel a lot.
And I'm shucking a lot of oysters there.
Yeah, so that was a good one. Elise said pied de cochon, which cochon. Which is a pig's foot that's braised, then stuffed with chicken sausage, sweetbreads, and mushrooms, and then fried.
Mm-hmm. So that's stuffing one thing inside of another.
There it is.
Yeah. Elise knows me.
Maybe she felt bad about that answer, and so she had an option, which was oxtail bourguignon.
Oh, okay.
Where you would be slowly cooked in a hot tub. So I think she was going a gentler route that way.
That was very sensitive.
Yeah. Which I think is what hot tubs do. I mean, they just kind of
gently cook you.
Basically, I think
it's
they
like
were
a giant sous vide.
Yeah, they were invented by cannibals, probably. And then a while later, So you might maybe want to offer her a raise at some point, because she spent a lot of time thinking about how you would die. A lot later, she replied...
This is still Elise.
Yes.
Jesus.
she replied, pork rinds, and she had a scenario. So she added that you'd be abandoned in the sun for too long until your skin got crispy.
What?
Yeah. And then a bit later...
More. She was really making sure it was covered.
She's really enjoyed the subject.
The idea of me dying in different ways.
I think she's just very, very thoughtful. But a bit later, she said that you like raw fish, so definitely being butchered would be another way for you to go. And lastly...
I'm not sure how much I'm enjoying this with her anymore.
She said that you love offal, so having your organs removed would probably be a part of it.
Oh, yeah, no, for sure. I'd definitely make a stew out of my guts.
Yeah. So that was great. I mean, it was midnight when I decided, you know, in true Dirk style, I'm like, I'm going to reach out and talk to people.
Yeah.
And she was right on it and had a lot of replies. So thank you, Elise. Tim said that you were known for refined plates and big, dumb French food.
Uh-huh.
So one dish that you do for parties is a whole roasted pig's head that is brought to the table, and then the mouth is filled with brandy and it's set on fire.
I do that, yeah.
Which...
Stupid, right?
It's pretty amazing.
It's fun.
Because when I asked Tommy, he replied with that photo.
Did he really?
Yeah.
That's so funny.
Instantly. And then the fish head that's stuffed with French fries.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I thought that was fascinating that all of these people clearly know you and your food. and two of them had the specific dish even.
Yeah.
They were like, oh, it would be this.
The flaming pig's head was something that I did as a joke. Mm-hmm. For somebody's birthday.
Yes.
I've done a number of different stupid dishes that people have asked me to do something ridiculous for them. I made one called a cockatrice, which is actually a medieval dish. Because back in the day when they had sort of chefs that worked in grand houses or chateaus or whatever, they only had access to a certain number of ingredients.
Yeah.
So they couldn't really go too far out with making things interesting. They would just make them weirder. So they started getting to a point where they would create fake animals out of other animal parts, right? It's like Franken animals.
Oh, it's
right?
Like the turducken.
No. Oh. So what they would do, because they don't cram it inside of another one.
Oh, okay.
This was one where they took the front end of a pig and they cut it in half, and then they sewed the back end of a goose onto it, or vice versa. So I did both. And, you know, I'm like, I had wire coat hangers around the goose's neck, so when it roasted, it would stay in, like, a certain shape.
Oh, my
gosh. They're the weirdest looking animals I've ever seen. Ironically, they actually cook at the same rate, which worked out perfectly.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it was weird to see a goose with, like, a weird little fat ass and, like, little short, stubby legs. That was a good one. Yeah, there's a bunch of that kind of stuff.
It's called a
cockatrice.
Cockatrice.
Uh-huh. Look it up.
Okay. That's amazing. So I think we can all agree that Jacqueline Bisset's bomb work in the movie is pretty incredible.
Yeah, super good.
What is a bomb?
A bomb is sort of a half dome.
Yeah.
Usually it's got like a cake base, and then it's going to have some sort of like mound of mousse or something in there, and they freeze that, and then once that's frozen, then they could put another layer of whatever on top of it until it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Kind of like a gobstopper.
Yes.
Okay. In theory, right? Yep. But soft.
Okay. The old soft gobstopper.
The old soft gobstopper.
Got it. Well, I loved that sequence because she looks like she has some skills at what she's doing.
Yeah.
You don't see too much cooking happening throughout the movie, but she's really good with a spatula.
She knows what she's doing.
Yeah, it's impressive.
She's got a good smear.
My next question for you is, would you accept the offer to be chef of an omelet restaurant?
No.
Okay.
No, that was one of the worst ideas I've heard in a long time for any kind of fast casual concept. I feel like I could talk to Kurt Huffman or, you know, somebody and see if maybe they'd be on board with an omelet restaurant.
Just omelets.
Yeah. Well, whatever. I mean, the guy was talking about he was making millions.
Yeah.
Millions. Back in the 70s, he was making millions of dollars.
Cracking a lot of eggs.
He was doing it.
Yeah. I bet now you'd have to do chickpea flour.
Mm-hmm. I feel like a real fucking asshole right now doing what I do. I work way too much.
Will you and your wife renew your vows in an omelet theme? Because that also happens in this movie.
Yeah. That was an odd... choice. I feel like at some point they just went off the rails there towards the end. There was the scene where, for whatever reason, all the French chefs were sitting at different tables in the same park, which when you first look at it is pretty like film noir. Like it was very like dark, very German 1960s kind of movie situation. And then it just got stupid.
Yeah.
But that part right there, I mean, why was he dressed as a chef? Their kids, will the chef kiss the chef? I mean, the whole thing.
Yeah.
That was just so bad.
There's so many strange things that happen within this movie. It's pretty incredible. I can't believe that I had never come across it before.
I feel like we'd probably do more of a sushi thing.
Right.
Honestly.
Yeah. No, that's true. That's a good point. All right. Well, we reached the sort of conclusion of the film portion. Do you have any final thoughts on what I like to call WIKTGCOE? You know, that's what the kids are saying.
Is that what they're saying right now?
Yeah. It's not too many chefs. They decided to just abbreviate.
Really hip with the kids right now. I had no idea.
I spent a lot of time with them. Well, mainly a five-year-old.
She didn't say that?
She didn't see this movie.
Okay.
But it is PG.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I can see that. It wasn't too... I mean, there was a lot of body talk.
Here's the great part about PG in 1978. They say shit three times. There's a nude man butt. And talk of breast kissing. Sure. All of that is totally fine in PG then.
It was the 70s.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody was chain smoking.
Yes.
Right? Like, the guys are working and they're hammered.
Yeah.
Right? People are like, this one woman is evidently the hottest woman on the planet because, like, every dude in Europe is going after her.
Yeah.
And saying a lot of, they're pinching her, they're doing the whole thing. I mean, the whole, I was trying to explain to somebody that, like, you have to just accept that kind of entertainment for what it is. This is a bigger topic, obviously.
Right.
You know, like, you can't take today and look at that and be like, God. You know, it's like, look, it was a different time. Open eyes moving forward.
Yes.
You know, like, we're all in a different place. But, it definitely touched a lot of buttons that I feel like you could get sued for now.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I think you have to look at things as when they were made, you know, and then sort of like one of my favorite movies, Dude, starring John Cryer. And it's great. It's directed by Penelope Spheeris. I have it on DVD and Blu-ray. It's just a super fun movie about these punk rockers that go from New York and they're going to L.A. to change their lives or whatever, flees in it. And along the way, John Cryer becomes like a cowboy. And then the problematic part is that Daniel Roebuck becomes a Native American.
Oh.
So when I watched it a bunch as a kid, I didn't notice anything about this. Also, I was a child. Then when Penelope Spheeris for the release of the Blu-ray was going around, I went to Hollywood Theater and watched the movie in a crowd in Portland, Oregon. And when Daniel Roebuck has the speech of a Native American man... You could feel the
ears. Does he do a voice?
Oh, yes.
Oh, fuck.
He does he wears the outfit. Here, it's on the cover.
It's on the cover. I see. I thought that was the punk thing with the hair.
Yeah.
Jeez.
He does the voice and man. You felt the oxygen sucked out of the theater. And I was like horrified.
Because
you lose all the comedy part of that character.
Yeah.
It's rough. So anyway, sidebar there. But but I totally understand. That you just kind of have to.
Yeah.
And it is shocking sometimes when you're like, this was okay, but this was also PG. Whereas now things would be so.
Your kids are watching this.
Yeah. Oh, I watched it not this movie.
Well, if you think about it, even like Monty Python, I mean, there was like bums and things and all kinds of stuff going on in there too.
Yeah.
And that was a TV show.
Well, and as a kid, a lot of times that stuff you don't even understand.
No.
I watched Footloose with my family and. In the living room, and there's a part where at the end Kevin Bacon like punches a guy in a parking lot, and he says, "You bastard!" And I laughed to myself as a child and said, said bastard. And my dad was like, "Whoa, like you don't say that, you know." And I was so confused because I thought it just meant fish poop.
That makes sense.
Yeah, bastard. I knew those two words, and I thought, what a funny thing to say when you punch somebody.
That's a good cut down, though.
Just bastard. You should take that one to work.
Fish poop.
Yeah. So last questions here. Are there any common misconceptions about what it's like to be a chef?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I think that all of us are different, right? So, I don't know. It's a lot of work, you know, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of dedication to doing a certain thing. And it's a strength, it's almost unnatural, like the amount of care and like affection and whatever that we have for food.
Right.
It's a bit unnatural, you know. However, I know that the people who I've been lucky enough to work with who are in this industry are some of the best people you'll meet.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of who they are and how hard they work and the sense of humor that they carry with them throughout the day. The willingness to learn oftentimes. There's also a lot of fucking assholes out there.
Yeah.
You know, egos run rampant in this business. Booze and drugs run rampant in this mm-hmm. business. I feel like it's changing quite a bit now. You know, and I'm lucky. I never got caught up in any of it too much. So it was like one of those things where getting older just meant I was getting older. It didn't mean that I was like, you know, trying to cut anything out of my life or, you know, whatever. But yeah, it's definitely a hard path. You know, I think I'm very, very lucky to have gotten this far, but, you know, and knock on wood, we'll just keep plugging away. Yeah.
Well, you also have a lovely family. So how do you balance working long hours, having all these different teams that you're overseeing, these families working in the restaurants also? Yeah. How do you do all that?
Not always very well. You know, I guess the thing is when you get to a certain point, you're going to have to kind of become a grand overseer, right? And that becomes a different job than what I've got now.
Sure.
Right? I'm not big enough for that yet. So essentially, I have a very patient wife who is wonderful about letting me do what I want to do. We're lucky that it gives us a good life, you know? So it's essentially just one of those things where, like, she's very patient. My son... I also make sure that I'm, you know, I work late at night, but I'm also up every morning at 6. So,
yeah.
You know, I don't sleep much, but that's because I want to make sure I spend time with my family. So, mm-hmm. You know, I hang out with my little boy. I hang out with my wife and we, yeah, they come to the restaurant quite a bit too.
I always love to see that.
Mm-hmm.
Your wife does a great job of capturing your lives.
Well, it's good. I mean, it's kind of amazing to see how being raised in a restaurant environment,
yes.
What he's capable of now,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it blows my mind. He sat through a three and a half hour dinner at Verju in a private room in Paris.
Wow.
And he was ordering in French and he was sitting there for 3.5 hours, being polite, not getting too bored, you know, not having, and he was 5.
That's
you know
incredible.
What I mean? And like, he went to Paul Bocuse, right? This, like, massive historic restaurant, bastion of French cooking. And he sat there and, like, he's got on one side, I have a picture of it. On one side of him, he's got somebody carving a chicken that's been stuffed with truffles and cooked inside of a pig's bladder.
Of course.
And they're cutting that table side. And then next on his other shoulder, they've got a person who's taking a puff pastry shell off of an entirely roasted fish. And, like, he's just sitting there, like, looking at both of them and watching them do this thing. And,
wow. And
you know, in that same meal, he ate cured salmon, which he would never eat at home. And he ate, you know, filet mignon with truffles and, you know, seeing his face when the 3 dessert carts come up and
order
and you can have whatever you want and as much of it as you want. So he's able to just pick whatever the hell he wants. And the maitre d' was so kind to him. And, you know, it was shocking. You know?
Yeah.
And you see some of these other people who, like, it was like a once in a lifetime experience, and seeing a kid there kind of, you could see they were annoyed.
Yeah.
He wasn't being loud. He wasn't doing anything. He
no,
was being
yeah.
very cool, but, you know, they were just like, they didn't understand it.
Well, they're probably also kind of jealous because they didn't get to go there
as
a child.
I mean, he has no idea what,
oh, sure.
you know, some of the lucky things he's been able to do with this, but he, yeah, it's amazing to see what that's allowed for him, how polite he is now, how he's able to order different things, be experimental with things.
Mm-hmm. I always like it when you see photos of you going over the menu and he's sitting on your lap and,
yeah.
you know, to be a part of, like, the meeting part as well.
He loves helping with lineup, yeah.
That's great.
I don't know if everybody loves him helping with lineup, but he always has a lot to say. There's usually a few fart jokes in there when we're talking about dishes. But, yeah, he's a big part of the restaurant.
That's amazing.
For sure.
I love that. What is a good day like for you?
Well, it evolves, you know. It used to be a good day. It was a day when I could come in and, like, when I had just St. Jack, it was just a day that was just like every other. I'm a creature of habit. I love being able to go to work at the same time every day, have my coffee, look at what I have to do that day, start with my butchery, and then go into the other stuff. Things are different now, though, you know.
And,
so now it's... a good day is being able to check in, make sure everybody's doing well and everybody's comfortable and feeling good. All the restaurants are at different places in their life, right? So it's like Scotch Lodge. It's talking to everybody about reviewers coming in, mm-hmm. media and VIPs and, you know, making sure that we're as tight as we can be. And even though we want to change a dish, we don't change it yet because we want to wait until, you know, for consistency's sake.
Right.
At St. Jack, it's more about working with Ben on new stuff. And he's so on top of that stuff. So I actually had to tell him the other day to stop being so creative because I need stuff to do.
Sure.
So he and I, you know, work together on menu stuff, parties. St. Jack's a big moving. There's a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of like private events and parties and mm-hmm. buyouts and all kinds of things. So a lot of chatting about those things. And so for me, it's just a matter of making sure everybody's okay, you know, and making sure everybody's happy, you know, checking in with Val, checking in with Joanna, checking in with all the people who make these places operate every day. You know, sometimes I feel like I'm just everybody's dad. And that's a role that was weird to roll into.
Yeah.
When you realize that you're that age where like everybody looks at you like their dad.
Yeah.
Like, cool dad.
Sure.
You know?
Well, I do these expanded sauce tasting things for Marshall's Hot Sauce. And, I realized that I'm not 20. The other day when I was doing one for two people that were 21, and they were like, where should we go in Portland? And I'm like, oh, there's this great natural wine bar. And they were just like, what are you talking about? And I was like, no, it's really good. And they're like, no, we want to go somewhere with a DJ. And I was like, oh, there's a DJ sometimes. And they play like old school hip hop. And the one girl just being nice was like, okay.
Cute.
And then her friend said, shut up. You don't like old school hip hop. And I was just like, oh, I don't know what kids do.
No, I feel like I'm like a pretty cool 42-year-old, you know, because we listen to music all day long, it's not mine,
yeah.
You know, so, you know, they'll put on whatever tunes they're listening to right now. Oftentimes it's like pretty aggressive metal, but it does evolve and change quite a bit.
We were there one time and it was like a lady trip hop situation, and I was
at night or during the day?
Night.
Oh, at night, those are just playlists. So okay. That's my other
hobby.
Because
I was like, who is this? And then you knew exactly who it was. And I was like, wow.
I make all the playlists for all the rest of
them. Okay, cool.
It's like my one hobby.
Yeah.
So, but during the day, it's like we basically listen to, I'm listening to what these guys are listening to, and they're all between sort of 24 and 28.
Sure.
So
it's a lot of Aqua, I'm a Barbie Girl.
You know, ironically, yes, there is some of that now and again, where like, you know, like Teddy Pendergrass comes on, and you're like, how do you even know who this guy is?
Well, I noticed that in some restaurants too, like Notogoro, Ryan Roadhouse will play some of the most ridiculous music.
Sure.
And I was like, why? If you're doing these like 30 course, super hardcore sushi dinners, and he's like, you've got to lighten it a little bit. It can't just be like this dire situation where you're like sitting there quietly.
No, it's awkward when you go into a place.
Yeah.
It's why we have playlists at our restaurants, is because actually Andy Ricker was the guy that told me this. He's like, if you only play music that you want to hear at your restaurants, you'll never listen to that music at home. And then you will stop loving music, essentially.
That makes sense.
And you know, it does. And, because when we first opened, I made a playlist of like all my favorite songs.
Yeah.
And it just didn't work. And then I made the actually Kyle Webster, who's the owner at Expatriate. He was our opening bar manager. And so he volunteered to make a list of primarily French stuff. And so and then after he left, I took that job over. But creating a playlist of things that aren't necessarily things that I listen to in the car.
Yeah.
But things that. And when you do, it's weird. You know, like you'll get into the car sometimes. And there was one day my wife got into the car and I turned it on and it sounded like somebody was playing The Saw.
Yeah.
You know, she was like, what the fuck are you listening to?
She like, just starts weeping.
It's just weird. Like it's just some weird stuff that pops on there. But you have to keep it light sometimes. Mm-hmm. Not everything can be a certain tempo. And you have to have some stuff that's going to be fun. And you have to have some stuff that's going to slow everything down.
Is there any pressure to put the Dandy Warhols on the playlist at St. Jack, or?
I think I did, actually. Yeah, and I keep waiting for
Courtney
to come in and when it's playing, and it hasn't happened yet.
And just,
it happened once within an hour, like an hour after he left came on, and I was like.
He just stands with you forehead to forehead for the duration of the song, singing into your eyes. And what would be a bad day for you?
Oh, a bad day is if you have to let somebody go. That's the worst day.
Staffing, I was going to guess.
Staffing, yeah. You know, staffing is always a hard thing. I don't like micromanaging people.
Yeah.
Which is weird for a chef. Yeah. I don't. I rely on people to use their best judgment. My guess is that most people don't want to suck at their job.
Yeah.
So if they do, it's not because of because they're not trying. So yeah, I mean that's usually bad. Other things that are bad, service can be great and can make you feel like $1 million at the end of it. It can also make you feel like you just want to die. There are nights where nothing goes right. All the tickets come in, people are sat too quickly at the same time, and then you get all the tickets at the same time, and then you don't feel like you've put as much effort in as you could have.
We came in one time when I think the dishwasher wasn't there or something, and so someone that was in your line was back there, and then you were expediting dishes, but then also jumping over to do raw.
Yeah.
And so we came in and sat down. You told us all this, and the first thing we ordered was something from the raw bar.
Did I yell at you?
Yeah,
probably.
And then, but in a joking way, is what we love. And that was amazing to see. And then the tickets were starting to like, kind of get discombobulated at the pass where we were sitting right next to it, and we were watching it happen, being like, oh, how is he gonna like balance all this? And within a moment, you'd walked over there, straightened everything out, and everything was back. Like, it was never off track, but it just looked like it was like something was going to happen.
It's a funny job. Like, expediting is one of those jobs where you see some people at restaurants and they'll have like an employee do it who doesn't really care.
Yeah.
And it looks really easy. Like, they're just sitting there and they're kind of staring off into space and sort of sending out plates. But like, the reason I do it is because I want to make sure that I'm seeing all the plates. Not that I don't trust the people who are making the food. I just, you know, like I like to make sure that I'm like the last line of defense, right? Between cold food or shitty food and what it's supposed to be. So that's why I still do that. And it's why I pretty much always stay till the last plate goes out. Whether, you know, I'm trying to get myself away from that. But I still do, by and large, do that. And it is, it's a tricky, expediting is a tricky art, you know, and making sure that you know when you're just looking at tickets, you're not looking at people, but you're imagining where these people are at in their experience. And like, they're probably done by now, but maybe the server forgot to fire the ticket or whatever. And so you're asking questions, you're making sure everything's kind of on par. So it always feels a little bit hard for me when I have to bounce back and forth between other stations in that way. But it happens, you know, it's life. You just got to deal with it.
Yeah. It's just fascinating to see, like, you said, what, 280 covers at St. Jack?
On a busy night, yeah.
Yeah. And you're balancing 280 individuals' evening. Because they're only going to experience that from their point of view.
Yeah.
And you have to balance the fact that,
luckily you've got a team of people doing that.
Sure.
So as much as I'd love to think it was just me, it's not.
But they're all ordering different, like, amounts of dishes and different coursing. And, you know, it always throws me
up. There are nights where people can just order, they'll just order wrong.
Right.
You know, like suddenly everybody decides they're only going to order one type of thing.
Yeah.
And it's all coming out of one person's station and that person just gets hosed.
We had Coquille St. Jack.
Yeah. And it's like, it's so hard because then you have to like run over and you're trying to help them and kitchens are small. So it's like, you don't want to be in their way. So it's tricky to figure out how best to help in these situations.
Yeah.
Oftentimes having good front of house people is important because they can go and chat with the guest and buy a little bit of time, or they can, you know, we can do something nice to kind of give them while they're waiting, or
a little bit of bubbly.
Yeah. You know, a little dog and pony show.
Mm-hmm.
A little dog and pony.
Great dog and pony.
I like
restaurants.
It.
Before we get to the last question, any final thoughts on what your experience was watching the film?
Well, I won't lie to you. It wasn't my favorite movie.
Oh.
It was definitely a tough one for me to want to finish. At points I was just like, the acting was pretty, like, she got nominated for an award.
Yeah.
Wow.
Imagine what the rest of the year
has. I
think it was just strictly bomb work. Is her working on
honestly,
the bomb, and everyone's like,
it was that smear. I told you.
Probably give her an award.
She's pretty good.
I don't see Sandy Duncan doing it.
I don't have any thoughts on that.
Perfect.
I thought that the characters were comical. Yeah. I have seen old chefs who do remind me of some of those guys for sure.
Yeah, I think it should be remade.
I am leery
or
to have
rebooted.
Anybody. Yeah, who are they going to put in these characters?
They should reboot. There could be Wolfgang Puck could be one of them. I mean, what celebrity chef wouldn't you want to put in there?
Well, no, you're not putting real chefs in, hey?
Oh, no, we would. For the reboot,
you
got to go
more
with real
terrible
ones.
Acting?
Yes. Emeril Lagasse.
He had his own TV show for a minute, so he's
Bam
got chops.
Was his thing.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, he'd be what, hit by a bus? I guess it's not a dish, but we've reached the final question, and it's my favorite. What are your dreams like?
I don't remember them.
No dreams? No work dreams?
No.
Wow.
It's really rare. I think I have dreams now and again. Usually they're not.
It's not the past. It's not delicious French food that you've had in France.
No. Just no, I rarely ever remember.
Well, you don't sleep long enough for...
I probably hit REM at some point, right? I'm pretty sure. It's one of those things. I've never really remembered my dreams very well. And I don't have a lot of anxiety dreams. So
that's good.
Yeah, I've never been one of those people who has like work dreams or
you know,
showing up with no pants on or whatever. It's not like a thing.
You could do that in the 70s.
I mean, I do it anyway. I actually dream of not wearing pants. Not. My dreams are all pretty like innocuous and stupid. Like they just don't make sense.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's good to hear. It sounds like you're mentally in a good place.
That's
then.
Not the case, but yeah, I mean,
all right. I try to find a good spin for it every time because I do love the question, and then I'm always like, what am I supposed to do with this answer?
Are you always let down? Or do people give you good
just
ones?
Just today, no. No, there's good ones. There was one person who always dreams, their dreams always take place in the same houses, so like they have like a dream neighborhood.
Oh, weird.
Which is pretty fascinating. I initially thought it was all going to be work because when I first thought of the question, it's because when I worked in retail so long ago when I met my wife, you dream about folding shirts because that's like the nightmare is you just watch kids walk up and just destroy a stack of shirts and you have to go over and board fold it for whatever. Or tapestries. It was at Urban Outfitters where we met and they used to have these big bolts of fabric that you could buy. And despite taping them and having sizes, the only thing people wanted to do was take them and put them on the ground and look at how big the tapestries were or
Wait,
the
who's
rugs.
Who's buying tapestries?
Not many people, but they loved to unfold them.
That's like a little level of hell.
Yeah, it was really awful. So that's what I would dream about back then. But then when I worked with people, I rarely dreamt of work.
Yeah.
It was more like what I dreaded, which was getting up in the morning.
Mm-hmm. I can see that.
Which is the worst. When you don't like to get up and like take a shower and go start your day, and then you dream that you've already done it, and then wake up and be like, what?
So let down.
Yeah, I've been robbed. It's awful. And no one understands why you're so mad at that time in the morning.
Oh, I'm not a good morning person, though.
Oh, yeah. I'm a coffee, slow waking.
Uh-huh.
The good thing about being in spicy food is that when we do markets and events, no one wants to talk to me for 2 hours because they're just like drinking their coffee.
Everybody's
they want
in the
anything
same
spicy.
Place.
Yeah, it's not until lunch. Yeah. So like I got a lot of time just to like acclimate. And whereas like people growing the farmers with their asparagus and strawberries, I mean, they've been
hammered.
Up for like 4 hours
just
before
crushed.
And they have a line, you know, that they're like people are like, I gotta pay $8 for 4 strawberries. It's the first of the year.
Do you ever help anybody else like when you're doing that or you just like sit around doing yoga?
Oh gosh, no.
No?
Mostly just point.
What a dick.
No,
just standing there.
I have to stand
sipping
there.
Your coffee while somebody's
yo,
getting...
Sarah's long gone. She doesn't have time to waste, you know, so I'm just like, I just stand there and drink my coffee, you know. But anyway, it's not about me. This has been about you and the movie Too Many Chefs.
Yeah.
Which is the alternate title. You gave it 8 stars, I think, and so
at least, yeah,
people should definitely buy it, which is what I did.
Should they buy it?
Yeah. So thank you for being
Have
here.
Have you seen this movie?
Yes.
Okay.
This is all just like stuff I wrote down from the internet. Yes. So thanks for being here, and thanks for watching the movie.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Of course. Links to our guest and topics of the conversation are up on the website vh-us.com. Please share our episode with anyone who you think would be interested. Rate, review, and what have you on your preferred platforms. If you would like to follow along visually, our Instagram is vh.us. If you're going to be in Portland, Oregon, or you live in Portland, Oregon, and you would like to be a guest, then please put guest and your profession in the heading of the email. If you'd like to recommend a movie, then please put movie and the title in the heading. Thank you for listening. I'd also like to thank my engineer, JL, and my producer, Wade Allen, and of course, my amazing wife, Sarah Marshall. Until next time, I'm Dirk Marshall, and this has been VHS.